Chapter 3. I'm 10, playing in the Nationals, second round. I lose badly to some kid who's older, who's supposed to be the best in the country. Not that this makes it easier. How can losing hurt so much? How can anything hurt so much? I walk off the court wishing I were dead. I stagger out to the parking lot. As my father gathers our stuff and says goodbye to the other parents, I sit in the car, crying. A man's face appears in the car window, black guy, smiling.
"Hey there," he says. "My name's Rudy."
Same name as the man who helped my father build his backyard tennis court. Strange.
"What's your name?"
"Andre." He shakes my hand.
"Nice to meet you, Andre."
He says he works with the great champion Pancho Segura, who coaches kids my age. He comes to these big tournaments to scout kids for Pancho. He puts his arms through the window, leans heavily on the car door, sighs. He tells me that days like this are tough, he knows, very tough indeed. But in the end, these days will make me stronger. His voice is warm, thick, like hot cocoa.
"That kid who beat you. Why, that kid's 2 years older than you. You've got 2 years to reach that kid's level. 2 years is an eternity, especially when you're working hard. Do you work hard?"
"Yes, sir."
"You've got so much ahead of you, son."
"But I don't want to play anymore. I hate tennis."
"Ha ha! Sure you do, right now. But deep down, you don't really hate tennis."
"Yes, I do."
"You just think you hate it."
"No, I hate it."
"You're saying that because you're hurting right now. Hurting like heck. But that just means you care. Means you want to win. You can use that. Remember this day. Try to use this day as motivation. If you don't want to feel this hurt again, good. Do everything you can to avoid it. Are you ready to do everything?" I nod. "Fine, fine. So go ahead and cry, hurt a while longer, but then tell yourself, that's it. Time to get back to work."
"Okay." I wipe my tears on my sleeve and thank Rudy, and when he walks away, I'm ready to practice. Bring on the dragon. I'm ready to hit balls for hours. If Rudy were standing behind me, whispering encouragement in my ear, I think I could beat that dragon. Suddenly, my father climbs behind the wheel of the car, and we drive slowly away, like the head car in a funeral procession. The tension in the car is so thick that I curl up on the back seat and close my eyes. I think about jumping out, running away, finding Rudy and asking him to coach me, or adopt me. I hate all the junior tournaments, but I hate nationals most of all, because the stakes are higher, and they're held in other states, which means airfare, motels, rental cars, restaurant meals. My father is shelling out money, investing in me, and when I lose, there goes another piece of his investment. When I lose, I set back the whole Agassi clan. I'm 11, playing nationals in Texas on clay. I'm among the best in the nation on clay, so there's no way I'm going to lose. And then I lose. In the semis. I don't even reach the final. Now I have to play a consolation match. When you lose in the semis, they make you play a match to determine third and fourth place. Worse, in this particular consolation match, I'm facing my arch nemesis, David Cass. He's ranked just below me, but somehow becomes a different player when he sees me across that net. No matter what I do, Cass beats me, and today is no different. I lose in 3 sets. Again, I'm shattered. I've disappointed my father. I've cost my family. I don't cry, however. I want to make Rudy proud, so I manage to choke back the tears. At the awards ceremony, a man hands out the first place trophy, then second, then third. Then he announces that this year, a sportsmanship trophy will be awarded to the youngster who exhibits the most grace on the court. Incredibly, he says my name, maybe because I've been biting my lip for an hour. He's holding the trophy toward me, waving me to come and get it. It's the last thing in the world I want, a sportsmanship trophy. But I take it from the man and thank him, and something shifts inside me. It is an awfully cool trophy, and I have been a good sport. I walk out to the car, clutching the trophy to my chest, my father a step behind me. He says nothing. I say nothing. I concentrate on the click-clack of our footsteps on the cement. Finally, I break the silence. I say, "I don't want this stupid thing." I say it because I think it's what my father wants to hear. My father comes alongside me. He rips the trophy from my hands. He lifts it over his head and throws it on the cement. The trophy shatters. My father picks up the biggest piece and throws it on the cement, smashing it into smaller pieces. Now he collects the pieces and throws them into a nearby dumpster. I don't say a word. I know not to say a word. If only I could play soccer instead of tennis. I don't like sports, but if I must play a sport to please my father, I'd much rather play soccer. I get to play 3 times a week at school, and I love running the soccer field with the wind in my hair, calling for the ball, knowing the world won't end if I don't score. The fate of my father, of my family, of planet Earth, doesn't rest on my shoulders. If my team doesn't win, it will be the whole team's fault, and no one will yell in my ear. Team sports, I decide, are the way to go. My father doesn't mind my playing soccer because he thinks it helps my footwork on the court. But I recently hurt myself in a soccer scrimmage, pulled a muscle in my leg, and the injury forces me to skip tennis practice one afternoon. My father isn't happy. He looks at my leg, then me, as if I injured myself on purpose. But an injury is an injury. Even he can't argue with my body. He stomps out of the house. Moments later, my mother looks at my schedule and realizes I have a soccer game this afternoon. "What do we do?" she says. "The team is counting on me," I tell her. She sighs. "How do you feel?" "I think I can play." "Okay, put on your soccer uniform." "Do you think Pops will be upset?" "You know Pa. He doesn't need a reason to be upset." She drives me to the soccer game and leaves me there. After a few jogs up and down the field, my leg feels good, surprisingly good. I dart in between defenders, fluid, graceful, calling for the ball, laughing with my teammates. We're working toward a common objective. We're in this together. This feels right. This feels like me. Suddenly, I look up and see my father. He's at the edge of the parking lot, stalking toward the field. Now he's talking to the coach. Now he's yelling at the coach. The coach is waving to me.
"Agassi, out of the game!"
I sprint off the field.
"Get in the car," my father says, "and get out of that uniform."
I run to the car and find my tennis clothes on the back seat. I put them on and walk back to my father. I hand him my soccer uniform. He walks onto the field and throws the uniform at the coach's chest. As we drive home, my father says without looking at me, "You're never playing soccer again." I beg him for a second chance. I tell my father that I don't like being by myself on that huge tennis court. "Tennis is lonely," I tell him. "There's nowhere to hide when things go wrong. No dugout, no sideline, no neutral corner. It's just you out there, naked." He shouts at the top of his lungs, "You're a tennis player. You're going to be number one in the world. You're going to make lots of money. That's the plan, and that's the end of it." He's adamant and desperate, because that was the plan for Rita, Philly, and Tammy, But things never worked out. Rita rebelled. Tammy stopped getting better. Philly didn't have the killer instinct. My father says this about Philly all the time. He says it to me, to Mom, even to Philly, right to his face. Philly just shrugs, which seems to prove that Philly doesn't have the killer instinct. But my father says far worse things to Philly. "You're a born loser," he says. "You're right," Philly says in a sorrowful tone. "I am a born loser. I was born to be a loser."
"You are. You feel sorry for your opponent. You don't care about being the best."
Philly doesn't bother to deny it. He plays well, he has talent, but he just isn't a perfectionist, and perfection isn't the goal in our house. It's the law. If you're not perfect, you're a loser. A born loser. My father decided that Philly was a born loser when Philly was about my age, playing nationals. Philly didn't just lose. He didn't argue when his opponents cheated him, which made my father turn bright red and scream curses in Assyrian from the bleachers. Like my mother, Philly takes it and takes it, and then, every once in a great while, he blows. The last time it happened, my father was stringing a tennis racket, my mother was ironing, and Philly was on the couch, watching TV. My father kept after Philly, mercilessly nagging him about his performance at a recent tournament. All at once, in a tone I'd never heard him use, Philly screeched,
"You know why I don't win? Because of you! Because you call me a born loser!"
Philly started panting with anger. My mother started crying.
"From now on," Philly continued, "I'll just be a robot. How's that? Would you like that? I'll be a robot and feel nothing and just go out there and do everything you say."
My father stopped stringing the racket and looked happy, almost peaceful.
"Jesus Christ," he said. "You're finally getting it."
Unlike Philly, I argue with opponents all the time. I sometimes wish I had Philly's knack for shrugging off injustice. If an opponent cheats me, if he pulls a Tarango, my face gets hot. Often, I get my revenge on the next point. When my cheating opponent hits a shot in the center of the court, I call it out and stare at him with a look that says, "Now we're even." I don't do this to please my father, but it surely does. He says,
"You have a different mentality than Philly. You got all the talent, all the fire, and the luck. You were born with a horseshoe up your ass."
He says this once a day. Sometimes he says it with conviction, sometimes admiration, sometimes envy. I blanch when he says it. I worry that I got Philly's good luck, that I stole it from him somehow, because if I was born with a horseshoe up my ass, Philly was born with a black cloud over his head. When Philly was 12, he broke his wrist while riding his bike, broke it in 3 places, and that was the beginning of a long stretch of unbroken gloom. My father was so furious with Philly that he made Philly keep playing tournaments, broken wrist and all, which worsened Philly's wrist, made the problem chronic, and ruined his game forever. Favoring his broken wrist, Philly was forced to use a one-handed backhand, which Philly believes is a terrible habit, one he couldn't break after the wrist healed. I watch Philly lose and think, bad habits plus bad luck, deadly combination. I also watch him when he comes home after a hard loss. He feels so rotten about himself. You can see it all over his face, and my father drives that rottenness down deeper. Philly sits in a corner, beating himself up over the loss. But at least it's a fair fight, one-on-one. Then along comes my father. He jumps in and helps Philly gang up on Philly. There is name-calling, slapping. By rights, this should make Philly a basket case. At the very least, it should make him resent me, bully me. Instead, After every verbal or physical assault at the hands of himself and my father, Philly's slightly more careful with me, more protective, gentler. He wants me spared his fate. For this reason, though he may be a born loser, I see Philly as the ultimate winner. I feel lucky to have him as my older brother. Feeling lucky to have an unlucky older brother? Is that possible? Does that make sense? Another defining contradiction. Philly and I spend all our free time together. He picks me up at school on his scooter, and we go riding home across the desert, talking and laughing above the engine's insect whine. We share a bedroom at the back of the house, our sanctuary from tennis and pops. Philly is as fussy about his stuff as I am about mine, so he paints a white line down the center of the room, dividing it into his side and mine, ad court and deuce court. I sleep in the deuce court, my bed closest to the door. At night, before we turn out the lights, we have a ritual I've come to depend on. We sit on the edges of our beds and whisper across the line. Philly, 7 years older, does most of the talking. He pours out his heart, his self-doubts and disappointments. He talks about never winning. He talks about being called a born loser. He talks about needing to borrow money from Pops so that he can continue to play tennis, to keep trying to turn pro. Pops, we both agree, is not a man you want holding your marker. Of all the things that trouble Philly, however, the great trauma of his life is his hairline. Andre, he says, I'm going bald. He says this in the same way he would tell me the doctor has given him 4 weeks to live. But he won't lose his hair without a battle. Baldness is one opponent Philly will fight with all he's got. He thinks the reason he's going bald is that he's not getting enough blood to his scalp. So every night, at some point during our bedtime talks, Philly stands upside down. He puts his head on the mattress and lifts his feet, balancing himself against the wall. I pray it will work. I plead with God that my brother, the born loser, won't lose this one thing, his hair. I lie to Philly and tell him that I can see his miracle cure working. I love my brother so much, I'd say anything if I thought it would make him feel better. For my brother's sake, I'd stand on my own head all night. After Philly tells me his troubles, I sometimes tell him mine. I'm touched by how quickly he refocuses. He listens to the latest mean thing Pop said, gauges my level of concern, then gives me the proportionate nod. For basic fears, a half nod. For big fears, a full nod with a patented Philly frown. Even when upside down, Philly says as much with one nod as most people say in a 5-page letter. One night, Philly asks me to promise him something. Sure, Philly, anything. Don't ever let Pops give you any pills. Pills? Andre, you have to hear what I'm telling you. This is really important. Okay, Philly, I hear you. I'm listening. Next time you go away to Nationals, if Pop gives you pills, don't take them. He already gives me Excedrin, Philly. He makes me take Excedrin before a match because it's loaded with caffeine. Yeah, I know. But these pills I'm talking about are different. These pills are tiny, white, round. Don't take them, whatever you do. What if Pops makes me? I can't say no to Pops. Yeah, right. Okay, let me think. Philly closes his eyes. I watch the blood rushing to his forehead, turning it purple. Okay, he says. I got it. If you have to take the pills, if he makes you take them, play a bad match. Tank. Then, as you come off the court, tell him you were shaking so bad that you couldn't concentrate. Okay. But, Philly, what are these pills?
Speed.
What's that?
A drug. Gives you lots of energy. I just know he's going to try to slip you some speed.
How do you know, Philly?
He gave it to me.
Sure enough, at the Nationals in Chicago, my father gives me a pill.
Hold out your hand, he says. This will help you. Take it.
He puts a pill on my palm. Tiny, white, round. I swallow the pill and feel okay. Not much different. Slightly more alert. But I pretend to feel very different. My opponent, an older kid, poses no challenge. And still I carry him, drag out points, hand him several games. I make the match look tougher than it is. Walking off the court, I tell my father I don't feel right. I want to pass out. And he looks guilty.
Okay, he says, rubbing his hand across his face. That's not good. We won't try that again.
I phone Philly after the tournament and tell him about the pill. He says, I fucking knew it! I did just what you told me to do, Philly, and it worked. My brother sounds the way I imagine a father is supposed to sound, proud of me and scared for me at the same time. When I return from Nationals, I grab him and hug him, and we spend my first night home locked in our room, whispering across the white line, cherishing our rare victory over Pops. A short time later, I play an older opponent and beat him. It's a practice match, no big deal, and I'm much better than the opponent. But once again, I carry him, drag out points, make the match look tougher than it is, just as I did in Chicago. Walking off Court 7 at Cambridge, the same court on which I beat Mr. Brown, I feel devastated, because my opponent looks devastated. I should have tanked all the way. I hate losing, but I hate winning this time because the defeated opponent is Philly. Does this devastated feeling prove I don't have the killer instinct? Confused, sad, I wish I could find that old guy, Rudy, or the other Rudy before him, and ask them what it all means. Chapter 4. I'm playing a tournament at the Las Vegas Country Club, vying for a chance to go to the state championship. My opponent is a kid named Roddy Parks. The first thing I notice about him is that he too has a unique father. Mr. Parks wears a ring with an ant frozen inside a large gumdrop of yellow amber. Before the match starts, I ask him about it.
You see, Andre, when the world ends in a nuclear holocaust, ants will be the only things that survive. So I'm planning for my spirit to go into an ant.
Roddy is 13, 2 years older than I, and big for his age, with a military crew cut. But he looks beatable. Right away, I see holes in his game, weaknesses. Then, somehow, he fills in the holes, papers over the weaknesses. He wins the first set. I talk to myself, tell myself to suck it up, dig in. I take the second set. Bearing down now, I play smarter, quicker. I feel the finish line. Roddy is mine. He's toast. What kind of name is Roddy anyway? But a few points slip away, and now Roddy is raising his arms above his head. He's won the third set, 7-5, and the match. I look into the stands for my father, and he's staring down, concerned. Not angry, concerned. I'm concerned, too, but damned angry also, sick with self-loathing. I wish I were the frozen ant in Mr. Parks' ring. I'm saying hateful things to myself as I pack my tennis bag. Out of nowhere, a boy appears and interrupts my rant.
Hey, he says. Don't sweat it. You didn't play your best today.
I look up. The boy is slightly older than I, a head taller, wearing an expression that I don't like. There's something different about his face. His nose and mouth are out of alignment. And the capper. He's wearing a fruity shirt with a little man playing polo. I want no part of him.
Who the fuck are you? I say. Perry Rogers.
I turn back to my tennis bag. He won't take a hint. He drones on about how I didn't have my best game, how much better I am than Roddy, how I'll beat Roddy the next time, blah, blah. He's trying to be nice, I guess, but he's coming off like a know-it-all, some kind of Bjorn Borg Jr. So I stand and pointedly do an about-face. The last thing I need is a consolation speech, which is more pointless than a consolation trophy, especially from a kid with a man playing polo on his chest. Slinging my tennis bag over my shoulder, I tell him, "What the fuck do you know about tennis?" Later, I feel bad. I shouldn't have been so harsh. Then I find out the kid is a tennis player, that he was competing in the same tournament. I also hear he's got a crush on my sister Tammy, which is undoubtedly why he talked to me in the first place, trying to get close to Tammy. But if I feel guilty, Perry is pissed. Word spreads along the Vegas teenager grapevine. Watch your back. Perry is gunning for you. He's telling everyone that you disrespected him, and the next time he sees you, he's going to kick your ass. Weeks later, Tammy says the whole gang is going to see a horror flick, all the older kids, and she asks me if I want to go along.
That Perry kid going?
Maybe.
Yeah, I'll go.
I love horror movies. And I have a plan. Our mother drives us to the theater early so we can buy popcorn and licorice and find the perfect seats, dead center, middle row. I always sit dead center, middle row. Best seats in the house. I put Tammy to my left and save the seat to my right. Sure enough, here comes Preppy Perry. I jump to my feet and wave.
"Hey, Perry, over here."
He turns, squints. I can see he's caught off guard by my friendliness. He's trying to analyze the situation, weigh his response. Then he smiles, visibly releases whatever anger he's been holding. He saunters down the aisle and slides down our row, throwing himself into the seat next to me.
"Hey, Tammy,"
he says across me.
"Hey, Perry."
"Hey, Andre."
"Hey, Perry."
Just as the lights go down and the first coming attraction starts, we give each other a look.
"Peace?"
"Peace." The movie is Visiting Hours. It's about a psycho who stalks a lady journalist, sneaks into her house, kills her maid, then, for some reason, puts on lipstick and pops out when the lady journalist comes home. She fights free and somehow gets to a hospital where she thinks she's safe. But of course, the psycho is hiding in the hospital, trying to find the lady journalist's room, killing everyone who gets in his way. Cheesy, but satisfyingly creepy. When scared, I react like a cat thrown into a room full of dogs. I freeze, don't move a muscle. But Perry, apparently, is the high-strung type. As the suspense builds, he twitches and fidgets and spills soda on himself. Every time the killer jumps out of a closet, Perry jumps out of his seat. Several times I turn to Tammy and roll my eyes. I don't tease Perry about his reaction, however. I don't even mention it when the lights come on. I don't want to break our fragile peace accord. We roll out of the theater and decide the popcorn and Cokes and Twizzlers weren't enough. We head across the street to Winchell's and buy a box of French crullers. Perry gets his covered with chocolate. I get mine with rainbow sprinkles. We eat the donuts at the counter, talking. Perry sure can talk. He's like a lawyer before the Supreme Court. Then, in the middle of a 15-minute sentence, he stops and asks the guy behind the counter,
"Is this place open 24 hours?
"Yup,"
the counter guy says.
7 days a week?
"Uh-huh."
365 days a year?
"Yeah."
"Then why are there locks on the front door?"
We all turn and look. What a brilliant question. I start laughing so hard that I have to spit out my cruller. Rainbow sprinkles are falling from my mouth like confetti. This might be the funniest, smartest thing anyone's ever said. Certainly the funniest, smartest thing said by anyone in this particular Winchell's. Even the donut guy has to smile and admit,
"Kid, that's a head-scratcher."
"Isn't life just like that?" Perry says. "Full of Winchell's locks and other stuff you can't explain?"
"You said it."
I always thought I was the only one who noticed. But here's a kid who not only notices, he points that stuff out. When my mother comes to pick up me and Tammy, I'm sad to say goodbye to my new friend Perry. I even find myself less annoyed by his polo shirt. I ask my father if I can sleep over at Perry's house.
"No fucking way," he says.
He doesn't know Perry's family from a hole in the ground, and he doesn't trust anyone he doesn't know. My father is suspicious of everyone in the world, especially the parents of our friends. I don't bother asking why, and I don't waste my breath arguing. I just invite Perry to our house for a sleepover. Perry is extremely polite with my parents. He's agreeable with my siblings, especially Tammy, though she's gently discouraged his crush. I ask if he wants a quick tour.
"Sure thing," he says.
So I show him the room I share with Philly. He laughs at the white stripe down the middle. I show him the court out back. He takes a turn hitting with the dragon. I tell him how much I hate the dragon, how I used to think it was a living, breathing monster. He looks sympathetic. He's seen enough horror flicks to know that monsters come in all shapes and sizes. Since Perry is a fellow connoisseur of horror, I've got a surprise for him. I've scored a beta copy of The Exorcist. After seeing him jump out of his skin at visiting hours, I can't wait to see how he reacts to a genuine horror classic. After everyone's asleep, we slide the movie into the machine. I suffer a minor aneurysm with every rotation of Linda Blair's head, but Perry doesn't flinch once. Visiting hours gives him the shakes, but The Exorcist leaves him cold? I think, this dude marches to his own drummer. Afterward, we sit up drinking sodas and talking. Perry agrees that my father's scarier than anything Hollywood can offer, but he says his father is twice as scary. His father, he says, is an ogre, a tyrant, and a narcissist. The first time I've heard this word. Perry says narcissist means he thinks only about himself. It also means his son is his personal property. He has a vision of how his son's life is going to be, and he couldn't care less about his son's vision of that future.
Sounds familiar.
Perry and I agree that life would be a million times better if our fathers were like the other kids' fathers. But I hear an added note of pain in Perry's voice, because, he says, his father doesn't love him. I've never questioned my father's love. I just wish it were softer, with more listening and less rage. In fact, I sometimes wish my father loved me less. Maybe then he'd back off, let me make my own choices. I tell Perry that having no choice, having no say about what I do or who I am, makes me crazy. That's why I put more thought, obsessive thought, into the few choices I do have, what I wear, what I eat, who I call my friends. He nods. He gets it. At last, in Perry, I have a friend with whom I can share these deep thoughts, a friend I can tell about the Winchell's locks in my life. I talk to Perry about playing tennis, despite hating tennis, hating school, despite enjoying books, feeling lucky to have Philly, despite his streak of bad luck. Perry listens, patient as Philly, but more involved. Perry doesn't just talk, then listen, then nod. He converses. He analyzes, strategizes, spitballs, helps me come up with a plan to make things better. When I tell Perry my problems, they sound jumbled and asinine at first. But Perry has a way of rearranging them, making them sound logical, which feels like the first step to making them solvable. I feel as if I've been on a desert island with no one to talk to but the palm trees, and now a thoughtful, sensitive, like-minded castaway, albeit with a stupid polo player on his shirt, has come stumbling ashore. Perry confides in me about his nose and mouth. He says he was born with a cleft palate. He says it's made him deeply self-conscious and painfully shy with girls. He's had surgeries to fix it, and faces one more surgery at least. I tell him it's not that noticeable. He gets tears in his eyes. He mumbles something about his father blaming him. Most conversations with Perry eventually lead to fathers, and from fathers it's a quick segue to the future. We talk about the men we're going to be once we're rid of our fathers. We promise each other that we'll be different, not just from our fathers, but from all the men we know, even the ones we see in movies. We make a pact that we'll never do drugs or drink alcohol, and when we're rich, we vow, we'll do what we can to help the world. We shake on it. A secret handshake. Perry has a long way to go to get rich. He never has a dime. Everything we do is my treat. I don't have much, a modest allowance, plus what I hustle from guests at the casinos and hotels. But I don't care. What's mine is Perry's, because I've decided that Perry is my new best friend. My father gives me $5 every day for food, and I freely spend half on Perry. We meet every afternoon at Cambridge. After goofing off, hitting a few balls around, we go for a snack. We slip out the back door, hop the wall, and race across the vacant lot to 7-Eleven, where we play video games and eat chipwiches, paid for by me, until it's time to go home. A chipwich is a new ice cream sandwich Perry recently discovered. Vanilla ice cream pressed between two doughy chocolate chip cookies. It's the greatest food in the world, according to Perry, who's a raging addict. He loves chipwiches more than talking. He can talk for an hour about the beauty of the chipwich, and yet a chipwich is one of the few things that can get him to stop talking. I buy him chipwiches by the dozens, and I feel sorry for him that he doesn't have enough money to feed his habit. We're at 7-Eleven one day when Perry stops chewing his chipwich and looks up at the wall clock. Shit, Andre, we better get back to Cambridge. My mother's coming early to get me.
Your mother?
Yeah, she said to be ready and waiting out front.
We haul ass across the vacant lot.
Uh-oh, Perry shouts. There she is.
I look up the street and see two cars cruising toward Cambridge, a Volkswagen Bug and a convertible Rolls-Royce. I see the Bug keep going past Cambridge, and I tell Perry to relax. We have time. She missed the turn.
No, Perry says. Come on, come on.
He turns on the jets, sprinting after the Rolls.
Hey, what the... Perry, are you kidding? Your mom drives a Rolls? Are you... rich?
I guess so.
Why didn't you tell me?
You never asked. For me, that's the definition of being rich. It doesn't cross your mind to mention it to your best friend, and money is such a given you don't care how you come by it. Perry, however, is more than rich. Perry is super rich. Perry is richy rich. His father, a senior partner at a major law firm, owns a local TV station. He sells air, Perry says. Imagine, selling air. When you can sell air, man, you've got it made. Presumably, his father gives him air for an allowance. My father finally lets me visit Perry's house, and I discover that he doesn't live in a house, in fact, but a mega mansion. His mother drives us there in the Rolls, and my eyes get big as we pass slowly up a massive front drive, around green rolling hills, then under enormous shade trees. We stop outside a place that looks like Bruce Wayne's stately manor. One entire wing is set aside for Perry, including a teenager's dream room, featuring a ping-pong table, pool table, poker table, big-screen TV, mini-fridge, and drum set. Down a long hallway lies Perry's bedroom, the walls of which are covered with dozens and dozens of Sports Illustrated covers. My head rotating on a swivel, I look at all the portraits of great athletes, and I can only say one word. Whoa. Did this all myself, Perry says. The next time I'm at the dentist, I tear off the covers of all the Sports Illustrateds in the waiting room and stash them under my jacket. When I hand them to Perry, he shakes his head. No, I have this one, and this one. I have them all, Andre. I have a subscription. Oh, okay. Sorry. It's not just that I've never met a rich kid. I've also never met a kid with a subscription. If we're not hanging out at Cambridge or at his mansion, Perry and I are talking on the phone. We're inseparable. He's crushed, therefore, when I tell him that I'm going away for a month to play a series of tournaments in Australia. McDonald's is putting together a team of America's elite juniors, sending us to play Australia's best. A whole month? I know, but I have no choice. My father. I'm not being entirely truthful. I'm one of only 2 12-year-olds selected, so I'm honored, excited, if slightly on edge about traveling so far from home. The plane ride is 14 hours. For Perry's sake, I downplay the trip. I tell him not to worry. I'll be back in no time, and we'll have a Chipwich feast. I fly alone to Los Angeles, and upon landing, I want to go straight back to Vegas. I'm scared. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to go or how to find my way through the airport. I feel as if I stick out in my warm-up suit with the McDonald's golden arches on the back and my name on the chest. Now, off in the distance, I see a group of kids wearing the same warm-up suit. My team. I approach the one adult in the group and introduce myself. He flashes a big smile. He's the coach. My first real coach.
Agassi, he says. The hotshot from Vegas. Hey, glad to have you aboard.
During the flight to Australia, Coach stands in the aisle, telling us how the trip is going to work. We're going to play 5 tournaments in 5 different cities. The most important tournament, however, will be the 3rd in Sydney. That's where we'll pit our best against the best Australians. There should be 5,000 fans in the arena, he says. Plus, it's going to be televised throughout Australia. Talk about pressure.
But here's the good news, Coach says. Every time you win a tournament, I'll let you have 1 cold beer.
I win my first tournament in Adelaide, no problem. And on the bus, Coach hands me an ice-cold Foster's Lager. I think of Perry and our pact. I think of how strange it is that I'm 12 and being served booze. But the beer can looks so frosty cold, and my teammates are watching. Also, I'm thousands of miles from home. Fuck it. I take a sip. Delicious. I drain it in 4 gulps, then wrestle with my guilty conscience the rest of the afternoon. I stare out the window as the outback crawls by, and I wonder how Perry will take the news, if he'll stop being my friend. I win 3 of the next 4 tournaments, 3 more beers, each more delicious than the last, but with every sip, I taste the bitter dregs of guilt. Perry and I fall right back into our old routine. Horror movies, long talks, Cambridge, 7-Eleven, Chipwiches. Every now and then, however, I look at him and feel the weight of my betrayal. We're walking from Cambridge to 7-Eleven, and I can't hold it in any longer. The guilt is eating away at me. We're each wearing headphones plugged into Perry's Walkman, listening to Prince, Purple Rain. I tap Perry on the shoulder and tell him to take off his headphones.
What's up?
I don't know how to say this. He stares.
What is it?
Perry, I broke our pact.
No.
I had a beer in Australia.
Just one?
Four.
Four?
I look down. He thinks. He stares off at the mountains.
Well,
he says, we make choices in life, Andre, and you've made yours. I guess that leaves me on my own. But a few minutes later, he's curious. He asks how the beers tasted, and again, I can't lie. I tell him they were great. I apologize again, but there's no point in pretending to be remorseful. Perry's right. I had a choice, for once, and I made it. Sure, I wish I hadn't broken our pact, but I can't feel bad about finally exercising free will. Perry frowns like a father. Not like my father or his father, but like a TV father. He looks as if he should be wearing a cardigan sweater and smoking a pipe. I realize that the pact Perry and I made, at its root, was a promise to become each other's fathers, to raise each other. I apologize once more, and I realize how much I missed Perry while I was gone. I make another pact with myself that I won't leave home again. My father accosts me in the kitchen. He says we need to talk. I wonder if he heard about the beer. He tells me to sit at the table. He sits across from me. An unfinished Norman Rockwell separates us. He describes a story he caught recently on 60 Minutes. It was all about a tennis boarding school on the west coast of Florida, near Tampa Bay. The first school of its kind, my father says. A boot camp for young tennis players. It's run by a former paratrooper named Nick Bollettieri.
So? So, you're going there.
What?
You're not getting any better here in Las Vegas. You've beaten all the local boys. You've beaten all the boys in the West. Andre, you've beaten all the players at the local college. I have nothing left to teach you.
My father doesn't say the words, but it's obvious. He's determined to do things differently with me. He doesn't want to repeat the mistakes he made with my siblings. He ruined their games by holding on too long, too tight. And in the process, he ruined his relationship with them. Things got so bad with Rita that she's recently run off with Pancho Gonzalez, the tennis legend, who's at least 30 years her senior. My father doesn't want to limit me, or break me, or ruin me. So, he's banishing me. He's sending me away, partly to protect me from himself.
Andre, he says, you've got to eat, sleep, and drink tennis. It's the only way you're going to be number one.
I already eat, sleep, and drink tennis. But he wants me to do my eating, sleeping, and drinking elsewhere.
How much does this tennis academy cost? About $12,000 a year.
We can't afford that.
You're only going for 3 months. That's $3,000.
We can't afford that either.
It's an investment in you. We'll find a way.
I don't want to go. I can see from my father's face it's settled. End of story. I try to look on the bright side. It's only 3 months. I can take anything for 3 months. Also, how bad could it be? Maybe it will be like Australia. Maybe it will be fun. Maybe there will be unforeseen benefits. Maybe it will feel like playing for a team.
What about school? I ask. I'm in the middle of seventh grade. There's a school in the next town, my father says. You'll go in the morning for half a day, then play tennis all afternoon and into the night.
Sounds grueling. A short time later, my mother tells me that the 60 Minutes report was actually an exposé on this Bolitari character, who was, in essence, running a tennis sweatshop that employed child labor. They give a goodbye party for me at Cambridge. Mr. Fong looks glum. Perry looks suicidal. My father looks uncertain. We stand around eating cake. We play tennis with the balloons, pop them with pins. Everyone pats me on the back and says what a blast I'm going to have. I know, I say. Can't wait to mix it up with those Florida kids. The lie sounds like a deliberate miss, like a ball off the wooden rim of my racket. As the day of my departure draws closer, I don't sleep well. I wake up thrashing, sweating, twisted up in the sheets. I can't eat. All at once, the concept of homesickness makes perfect sense. I don't want to leave my home, my siblings, my mother, my best friend. Despite the tension of my home, the occasional terror, I'd give anything to stay. For all the pain my father has caused me, the one constant has been his presence. He's always been there, at my back, and now he won't be. I feel abandoned. I thought the one thing I wanted was to be free of him, and now that he's sending me away, I'm heartbroken. I spend my last days at home hoping that my mother will come to my rescue. I look at her imploringly, but she looks back with a face that says, "I've seen him break 3 kids. You're lucky to be getting out while you're whole." My father drives me to the airport. My mother wants to go, but can't miss a day of work. Perry takes her place. He doesn't stop talking the whole way. I can't decide if he's trying to cheer me up or himself. "It's only 3 months," he says. "We'll write letters, postcards. You'll see. It's going to be fine. You're going to learn so much. Maybe I'll even come visit." I think about visiting hours. The cheesy horror movie we saw the night our friendship was born. Perry is acting now the way he acted then, the way he always reacts to fear, twitching, jumping out of his seat. And I'm reacting in my typical way, a cat thrown into a room full of dogs. Chapter 5. The airport shuttle pulls into the compound just after sunset. The Nick Bolitari Tennis Academy, built on an old tomato farm, is nothing fancy, just a few outbuildings that look like cell blocks. They're named like cell blocks, too. B building, C building. I look around, half expecting to find a guard tower and razor wire. More ominously, stretching off into the distance, I see row after row of tennis courts. As the sun sinks beyond the inky black marshes, the temperature plummets. I huddle into my t-shirt. I thought Florida was supposed to be hot. A staff member greets me as I step out of the van and marches me straight to my barracks, which are empty and eerily quiet. "Where is everyone?"
"Study hall," he says.
In a few minutes, it'll be free hour. That's the hour between study hall and bedtime.
"Why don't you go down to the rec center and introduce yourself to the others?"
In the rec center, I find 200 wild boys, plus a few tough-looking girls separated into tight cliques. One of the largest cliques is pressed around a Nerf ping-pong table, screaming insults at 2 boys playing. I press my back against a wall and scan the room. I recognize a few faces, including 1 or 2 from the Australia trip. That kid over there, I played him in California. That evil-looking homie right there, I played a tough 3-setter against him in Arizona. Everyone looks talented, supremely confident. The kids are all colors, all sizes, all ages, and from all around the world. The youngest is 7, the oldest 19. After ruling Las Vegas my whole life, I'm now a tiny fish in a vast pond, or marsh. And the biggest of the big fish are the best players in the country. teenage supermen who form the tightest clique in a far corner. I try to watch the ping-pong game. Even there, I'm outclassed. Back home, nobody could beat me at Nerf ping-pong. Here, half these guys would cream me. I can't imagine how I'll ever fit in at this joint, how I'll make friends. I want to go home right now, or at least phone home, but I'd have to call collect, and I know my father wouldn't accept the charges. Just knowing I can't hear my mother's voice or Philly's, no matter how much I need to, makes me feel panicky. When free hour ends, I hurry back to the barracks and lie on my bunk, waiting to disappear into the black marsh of sleep. 3 months, I tell myself. Just 3 months. People like to call the Boletari Academy a boot camp, but it's really a glorified prison camp. And not all that glorified. We eat gruel, beige meats, and gelatinous stews and gray slop poured over rice, and sleep in rickety bunks that line the plywood walls of our military-style barracks. We rise at dawn and go to bed soon after dinner. We rarely leave, and we have scant contact with the outside world. Like most prisoners, we do nothing but sleep and work, and our main rock pile is drills. Serve drills, net drills, backhand drills, forehand drills, with occasional match play to establish the pecking order, strong to weak. Sometimes it feels as though we're gladiators, preparing underneath the Colosseum. Certainly, the 35 instructors who bark at us during drills think of themselves as slave drivers. When we're not drilling, we're studying the psychology of tennis. We take classes on mental toughness, positive thinking, and visualization. We're taught to close our eyes and picture ourselves winning Wimbledon, hoisting that gold trophy above our heads. Then we go to aerobics or weight training or out to the crushed shell track where we run until we drop. The constant pressure, the cutthroat competition, the total lack of adult supervision, it slowly turns us into animals. A kind of jungle law prevails. It's Karate Kid with rackets, Lord of the Flies with forehands. One night, two boys get into an argument in the barracks, a white boy and an Asian boy. The white boy uses a racial slur and walks out. For a full hour, the Asian boy stands in the middle of the barracks, stretching, shaking out his legs and arms, rolling his back. He runs through a progression of judo moves, then, carefully, methodically tapes his ankles. When the white boy returns, the Asian boy spins, whipsaws his leg through the air, and unleashes a kick that shatters the white boy's jaw. The shocking part is that neither boy gets expelled, which greatly adds to the overall sense of anarchy. Another two boys have a low-grade, long-running feud. It's mostly taunts, teases, minor stuff, until one boy ups the ante. For days, he urinates and defecates into a bucket. Then, late one night, he bursts into the other boy's barracks and dumps the bucket on his head. The jungle feeling, the constant threat of violence and ambush, is reinforced, just before lights out, by the sound of drums in the distance. I ask one of the boys, "What the hell is that?"
"Oh, that's just courier. He likes to pound a drum set his parents sent him."
"Who?"
"Jim Courier, from Florida."
Within days, I get my first glimpse of the warden, founder, and owner of the Nick Boletari Tennis Academy. He's 50-something, but looks 250, because tanning is one of his obsessions, along with tennis and getting married. He's got 5 or 6 ex-wives, no one is quite sure. He's soaked up so much sun, baked himself so deeply beneath so many ultraviolet sun lamps, he's permanently altered his pigmentation. The one portion of his face that isn't the color of beef jerky is his mustache, a black, meticulously trimmed quasi-goatee, only without the chin hair, so it looks like a permanent frown. I see Nick striding across the compound, an angry red man in wraparound shades, berating someone who jogs alongside, trying to keep pace, and I pray that I never have to deal with Nick directly. I watch as he slides into a red Ferrari and zooms away, leaving a dorsal fin of dust in his wake. A boy tells me it's our job to keep Nick's four sports cars washed and polished.
Our job? That's bullshit.
Tell it to the judge. I ask some of the older boys, some of the veterans, about Nick. Who is he? What makes him tick? They say he's a hustler, a guy who makes a very nice living off tennis, but he doesn't love the game or even know it all that well. He's not like my father, captivated by the angles and the numbers and the beauty of tennis. Then again, he's just like my father. He's captivated by cash. He's a guy who flunked the exam for Navy pilots, dropped out of law school, then landed one day on the idea of teaching tennis. Stepped in shit. Through a bit of hard work and a ton of luck, he's turned himself into this image of a tennis titan, mentor to prodigies. You can learn a few things from him, the other kids say, but he's no miracle worker. He doesn't sound like a guy who can make me stop hating the game. I'm playing a practice match, putting a fairly good whooping on a kid from the East Coast, when I become aware that Gabriel, one of Nick's henchmen, is behind me, staring. After a few more points, Gabriel stops the match. He asks, "Has Nick seen you play yet?" "No, sir." He frowns, walks off. Later, over the loudspeaker that carries across all the courts of the Bolitari Academy, I hear,
"Andre Agassi to the Indoor Supreme Court. Andre Agassi, report to the Indoor Supreme Court. Immediately."
I've never been to the Indoor Supreme Court, and I can't imagine there's a good reason for my being summoned now. I run there and find Gabriel and Nick standing shoulder to shoulder, waiting. Gabriel says to Nick, "You've got to see this kid hit." Nick strolls off into the shadows. Gabriel gets on the other side of the net. He puts me through drills for half an hour. I sneak occasional glances over my shoulder. I can vaguely make out the silhouette of Nick, concentrating, stroking his mustache.
"Hit some backhands," Nick says.
His voice is like sandpaper on Velcro. I do as I'm told. I hit backhands.
"Now hit some serves."
I serve.
"Come to the net."
I come to the net.
"That's enough."
He steps forward.
"Where are you from?"
"Las Vegas."
"What's your national ranking?"
"Number 3.
"How do I reach your father?"
"He's at work. He works nights at the MGM.
"How about your mother?"
"At this hour, she's probably home."
"Come with me."
We walk slowly to his office, where he asks for my home number. He's sitting in a tall, black leather chair, turned almost away from me. My face feels redder than his face looks. He dials and speaks to my mother. She gives him my father's number. He dials again. He's yelling.
"Mr. Agassi, Nick Bolitari here."
"Right, right. Yes, well, listen to me. I'm going to tell you something very important. Your boy has more talent than anybody I've ever seen come through this academy."
"That's right, ever. And I'm going to take him to the top."
What the hell is he talking about? I'm only here for 3 months. I'm leaving here in 64 days. Is Nick saying he wants me to stay here? Live here forever? Surely my father won't go for that. Nick says,
"That's right. No, that's no issue. I'm going to make it so you won't pay a penny. Andre can stay free of charge. I'm tearing up your check."
My heart sinks. I know my father can't resist anything free. My fate is sealed. Nick hangs up and spins toward me in his chair. He doesn't explain. He doesn't console. He doesn't ask if this is what I want. He doesn't say a thing besides,
"Go back out to the courts."
The warden has tacked several years to my sentence, and there's nothing to be done but pick up my hammer and return to the rock pile. Every day at the Boletari Academy starts with the stench. The surrounding hills are home to several orange processing plants, which give off a toxic smell of burned orange peels. It's the first thing that hits me when I open my eyes, a reminder that this is real. I'm not back in Vegas. I'm not in my Deuce Court bed, dreaming. I've never cared much for orange juice, but after the Boletari Academy, I'll never be able to look at a gallon of Minute Maid again. As the sun clears the marshes, burning off the morning mist, I hurry to beat the other boys into the shower, because only the first boys get hot water. Actually, it's not a shower, just a tiny nozzle that shoots a narrow jet of painful needles, which hardly gets you wet, let alone clean. Then we all rush to breakfast, served in a cafeteria so chaotic it's like a mental hospital where the nurses forgot to hand out the meds. But you'd better get there early, or it might be worse. The butter will be filled with everyone else's crumbs, the bread will be gone, the plastic eggs will be ice. Straight from breakfast, we board a bus for school, Bradenton Academy, 26 minutes away. I divide my time between two academies, both prisons, but Bradenton Academy makes me more claustrophobic because it makes less sense. At the Boletari Academy, at least I'm learning something about tennis. At Bradenton Academy, the only thing I learn is that I'm stupid. Bradenton Academy has warped floors, dirty carpets, and a color scheme that's 14 shades of gray. There isn't one window in the building, so the light is fluorescent and the air is stale, filled with a medley of foul odors, chiefly vomit, toilet, and fear. It's almost worse than the scorched orange smell back at the Boletari Academy. Other kids, non-tennis kids from town, don't seem to mind. Some actually thrive at Bradenton Academy, maybe because their life schedules are manageable. They don't balance school with careers as semi-pro athletes. They don't contend with waves of homesickness that rise and fall like nausea. They spend 7 hours a day in class, then go home to eat dinner and watch TV with their families. Those of us who commute from the Boletari Academy, however, spend 4.5 hours in class, then board the bus for the long slog back to our full-time jobs, hitting balls until after dusk, at which time we collapse in heaps on our wooden bunks to grab a half hour of rest before returning to the original state of nature that is the rec center. Then we nod over our textbooks for a few futile hours before free hour and lights out. We're always behind on schoolwork and falling ever further behind. The system is rigged, guaranteed to produce bad students as quickly and efficiently as it produces good tennis players. I don't like anything that's rigged, so I don't give much effort. I don't study. I don't do homework. I don't pay attention, and I don't give a damn. In every class, I sit quietly at my desk, staring at my feet, wishing I were somewhere else, while the teacher drones on about Shakespeare or Bunker Hill or the Pythagorean theorem. The teachers don't care that I've tuned them out, because I'm one of Nick's boys, and they don't want to cross Nick. Bradenton Academy exists because the Boletari Academy keeps sending it a bus full of paying customers every semester. The teachers know that their jobs depend on Nick, so they can't flunk us, and we cherish our special status. We feel a lordly sense of entitlement, never realizing that the thing to which we're most entitled is the thing we're not getting, an education. Inside the metal front doors of Bradenton Academy stands the office, the nerve center of the school, and the source of much pain. Report cards and threatening letters emanate from the office. Bad boys are sent there. The office is also the lair of Mrs. G and Doc G, married co-principals of Bradenton Academy, and, I suspect, frustrated sideshow performers. Mrs. G is a gangly woman with no midsection. She looks as if her shoulders have been set directly on her hips. She tries to disguise this odd shape by wearing skirts, but this only accentuates the problem. On her face, she wears two gobs of blush and one smear of lipstick, a symmetrical triad of three circles that she color-coordinates the way other people do their shoes and belt. Her cheeks and mouth always match, and always almost distract you from the hump in her back. Nothing Mrs. G wears, however, can distract you from her gargantuan hands. She has mitts the size of rackets, and the first time she shakes my hand, I think I might faint. Old Doc G is half her size, but has just as many body issues. It's not hard to see what they first found in common. Frail, gamey, Doc G has a right arm that's been shriveled since birth. He ought to hide this arm, keep it behind his back, or shoved in a pocket. Instead, he waves it around, brandishes it like a weapon. He likes to take students aside for one-on-one chats, and whenever he does so, he swings his bad arm up onto the student's shoulder, setting it there until he's said his piece. If this doesn't give you the heebie-jeebies, nothing will. Doc G's arm feels like a pork tenderloin lying on your shoulder, and hours later, you can still feel it there, and you can't help but shiver. Mrs. G and Doc G have instituted dozens of rules at Bradenton Academy, and one of the most strictly enforced is their ban on jewelry. Thus, I go out of my way to pierce my ears. It's an easy show of rebellion, which, as I see it, is my last resort. Rebellion is the one thing I get to choose every day, and this rebellion comes with the added bonus that it represents a neat little fuck you to my father, who's always hated earrings on men. Many times I've heard my father say that earrings equal homosexuality. I can't wait for him to see mine. I buy both studs and dangly hoops. He'll finally regret sending me thousands of miles from home and leaving me here to be corrupted. I make a feeble and insincere effort to hide my new accessory, wrapping a band-aid around it. Mrs. G notices, of course, just as I hoped she would. She pulls me out of class and confronts me.
"Mr. Agassiz, what is the meaning of that bandage?"
"I hurt my ear."
"Hurt your..." "Don't be ridiculous. Remove that band-aid."
I pull off the band-aid. She sees the stud and gasps.
"We do not allow earrings at Bradenton Academy, Mr. Agassiz. The next time I see you, I will expect the band-aid gone and the earring out."